Sangye chutam sakhi chanam ma Changju bardu dhagmi kya suchi Yagi jinsi jibi sangyangi Drova pinche sangye chuparsho
I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I have learnt, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I have learnt, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount River, surrounded by the four continents, ornamented by the sun and moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha room, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparivara Ratnamanda Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samayi. Welcome to the fifth session of Parting from the Four Attachments. So we've been following the commentaries of these four lines. Mostly we've been following Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen's Song of Experience, which is one type of commentary. And he talked quite a bit about the three wisdom tools of listening, contemplation, and meditation. Plus he added morality to that. Common and authentic morality. Common morality, we all know what that is, just being a good person. But the inauthentic morality that he talked about is particularly important for practitioners. And he said there's two kinds of inauthentic morality. One are the eight worldly poisons. We talked quite a bit about that. Gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, fame and infamy. Or their various synonyms. And then the other kind is what he calls false moral conduct, which generally speaking is being arrogant, competitive, or jealous, or all three, depending on the object. And His Eminence the Sangha Vajra Rinpoche says that believing in the eight worldly poisons is believing in the big white lie. And I think he was being generous when he called it that. I think it's more accurate to call it dirty, poisonous lies. Because they are very, four of them particularly are hard to spot. Dzongtso Khenzi Rinpoche, who's a contemporary teacher, said, millions of people around the world are interested in some version of meditation or yoga, or one of the many so-called spiritual activities that are now so widely marketed. But a closer look at why people engage in these practices reveals an aim that has little to do with the liberation from delusion, and everything to do with their desperation to escape busy, unhappy lives, and a heartfelt longing for a healthy, stress-free, happy life. All of which are romantic illusions. So, where do we find the roots of these illusions? Mainly in our habitual patterns and their related actions. Of course, no one of sound mind imagines any of us would willingly live in illusion. But we are contrary beings, and even though we are convinced that we would shun a life built on self-deception, we continue to maintain a strong grip on the habits that are the causes of countless delusions. So, Drapa Gyaltsen's commentary is a song of experience, which one of his disciples wrote down as he sang it spontaneously based on his own experience. Drapa Gyaltsen was a yogi, a meditator, a mystic, a visionary. Although he wrote lots and lots of scholarly texts as well. We started with his commentary because it's so unusual and it's so different and so concise. And it's also kind of poetic too, it's a song. But we're also going to look at some of these other types of commentaries, which are more sort of straightforward intellectual type commentaries. But to transition, there was a commentary written by Sakyapandita on Drapa Gyaltsen's commentary. So it was a commentary on a commentary on a visionary experience that Drapa Gyaltsen's father had from the Buddha of Wisdom Manjushri. So there's this kind of lineage, so to speak. But Sakyapandita is probably the most famous Sakya master. He himself was considered to be a Manjushri emanation. He was born, and from birth he already spoke Sanskrit, for example. Great scholar, master, teacher. He wrote a few lines about Drapa Gyaltsen's description so far on the first attachment. And I think it's really brilliant because he goes into what we've been hearing so far about listening, contemplation, meditation, and he drills down into it and he says, I'll read you the quote in a second, but he has a tremendous insight which then caused a lot of these other commentaries to be written from this other angle, because not everybody had these mystical experiences where they had spontaneous songs. Not all of us have those. But Sakyapandita pointed out where we could go next after Drapa Gyaltsen's commentary on the first line, which we finished, by the way. And what Sakyapandita said is this. What has been written up to this point is in accordance with the Abhidhamma Kosha, where it states, through possessing hearing and contemplation that are based on moral conduct, you should thoroughly apply yourself to meditation. Thus, this directly shows the distinction between ultimate and relative aims, while indirectly it indicates the manner of meditating upon the difficulty of obtaining the 18 prerequisites and the impermanence of life. So let's talk about that, what he said. What does that mean? So first of all, the Abhidhamma Kosha that's a Sanskrit word. It's a key text on Abhidharma, written by the Indian scholar Vasubandhu in the 4th or 5th century. So what is Abhidharma? I'm sorry Stephen couldn't make it, because he and I had a long back and forth dialogue about how to define it, because it's a big word. And what we've decided is that for this context, Abhidharma we can define as the investigation of knowing, its nature, and its scope. Mm-hmm. In a simple way, it's the study of knowledge or knowing. Okay, so that's what Abhidharma is. Sakyapandita quotes the Abhidharma Kosha, written by Vasubandhu. Now, when he says it directly shows the distinction between ultimate and relative aims, that's basically what we've been talking about, is the relative aims. We don't want to get trapped up in this worldly stuff, the 8 poisons, being attached to this life, and so on and so forth. Those are all relative aims, as opposed to the ultimate aim, which is enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Sakyapandita says that we've been given that distinction directly so far in the commentary by Drapa Gyaltsen. But then he goes on to say, indirectly, it indicates the manner of meditating on the difficulty of obtaining the eight prerequisites and the impermanence of life. So what does that mean? This indirect pointing to these two topics, which are the preciousness of human rebirth and the impermanence of life, which by definition includes death. If life is impermanent, you die. Mm-hmm. So these are the two topics that most of the other commentaries focus on for the first line here. And so what Sakyapandita has done here is he's pointed us to these two new topics, which are sort of hidden in here. This is the whole path in four lines, so we have to dig into the lines to see what are the pieces of the path. So that's what Sakyapandita has done here with this very short commentary on the commentary. The first line being, if you're attached to this life, you're not a true Dharma practitioner. One might ask the question, well, okay, we've been taught how to apply authentic morality to listening, contemplation, and meditation. That's nice. But how do we actually do it? How do we actually sever attachment to this life? How do you do that? You know, if we want to become true Dharma practitioners, that's what we've been told we need to do. And then attain enlightenment for the sake of well-being. How do you do that? Well, the answer would be, or could be, we need to apply authentic morality to listening, contemplation, and meditation on these two topics, precious human rebirth, impermanence, and death. We need to dive into those and get them in a deep way inside of us, you know, integrated. Those are the two topics that we're now going to talk about from the point of view of other commentators. Because we finished whatever Drapa Gyaltsen has to say about it. He pointed to it, but he didn't really elaborate it. The other commentators, and remember, there have been 1,000 years of commentaries by great masters. And so we're going to shift gears a little bit from a different point of view from what we've been doing up till now. His Eminence Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche, who we've heard from many times up until this point, said about all this, we should train our mind by thinking. Why should I waste the valuable time I have set aside for meditation by meditating improperly with misguided intentions? If I do not rectify these faults now, while I have the opportunity of a precious human rebirth, then when will I again have the chance to redress and amend my practice? We will gain a renewed sense of conviction and encouragement by reflecting on the precious human rebirth. So that's what Rinpoche said. By the way, Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche was a 20th century saint. I think he was a living Buddha. He was really an amazing being, and amazingly enough, he came here to Victoria and taught and gave an empowerment. He used to bless water, and people used to line up. There's videos online, you can see this, to get his holy water because it would cure incurable diseases, and was like really a saint, as well as a scholar and a yogi. So that's what he said. Now, I'm going to introduce another important commentator, Norchen Kunga Zangpo, who lived from 1382 to 1456. He's credited with founding the Nor sub-school of the Sakya school, or sub-sect, however you want to say it. He was a great tantric master, and we're going to be hearing from him a bit. And in the first comment that he made in his commentary, he quotes the 8th century master Shantideva, which probably some of you have heard of. And he quotes Shantideva's work, the Bodhicharyavatara, which is translated as a guide to entering the Bodhisattva's way of life. And what Shanti Deva said that's being quoted is, this opportunity of possessing the 18 prerequisites is extremely difficult to obtain. Having obtained it, you must accomplish the purpose of others. If benefit is not accomplished, it will be difficult to gain this opportunity again. And then His Eminence Choge Trichen Rinpoche continues to say, pondering the rarity and the value of this precious human rebirth will cause us to appreciate the opportunity we have, and consequently it will arouse in us great diligence. Understanding that death is inevitable, we will be able to generate great enthusiasm for genuine moral discipline, contemplation, and meditation, so that our life will not be wasted on fruitless pursuits and practices. Contemplating well the difficulty of obtaining precious human rebirth, together with meditating on the nature of impermanence, will foster a great zeal for practice in us, infusing our practice with a quality of deep sincerity. This attitude will in turn engender tremendous progress on the path of Dharma. Never take the privilege of this life for granted. Meditate on the law of impermanence and death so that you can truly avail yourself of this precious opportunity. Then you will not inadvertently go astray. Precious human life offers a unique chance to gain liberation not afforded by other types of rebirth. These teachings ought to convince you that even having gained a precious human rebirth, a human birth in which one encounters the holy Dharma, many will squander it on superficial forms of practice that can only bear bitter fruit. Contemplate these points in order to arouse the motivation that you will not engage in Dharma practices out of concern for the goals of this life alone. The superficial forms of practice that he makes reference to are what Drapa Gyaltsen called inauthentic morality. You know, that I pretend to be a practitioner, but really I'm judging everybody else and competing and looking up and looking down. The Dharma practices out of concern for the goals of this life, that refers to the 8 worldly poisons that we've talked about. So he's saying avoid those, obviously. We're going to have 2 contemplations here. One is precious human rebirth and one is impermanence and death. So we're going to start with precious human rebirth. And the contemplation is to reflect on the difficulty of attaining the precious human rebirth. And we're going to talk about why it's difficult. The 18 prerequisites of precious human rebirth are difficult to obtain from different points of view. The points of view being cause, number, examples, and nature. Cause, the first one. In order to progress spiritually, we need to perform virtuous deeds. We've talked about this before. And that's the discussion about moral conduct and abandoning non-virtuous deeds, which we've talked about before. But the teaching on this says that, having said that, the number of living beings in the 3 realms of desire, form, and formless, the number of living beings is infinite. And the number of living beings actually performing virtuous deeds, such as true moral conduct, is few. There aren't many beings doing this. Remember, we're not just talking about human beings, we're talking about all living beings, animals, spirits, you name it. And the number who are actually practicing this authentic morality that we've been talking about, that number is few. And the number performing non-virtuous deeds is greater. And so we should therefore meditate on the idea of the difficulty of obtaining the precious human rebirth from the viewpoint of cause. Okay. The main cause of a human rebirth is morality. Generosity is a supplemental cause, if you will. But the main cause is morality. The second point of view is from the point of view of number. And Nochin Kunga Zangbo says, when looking upon the sentient beings of this world, you will see that the number in the hell realms to be as many as dust particles on the earth. The number of hungry ghosts to be as many as snowflakes tossed about in a snowstorm. And the number of animals to be as many as the fermented grains in a vat of beer. I'm not sure how many that is, but in comparison with these, the number of those who have attained the perfect human body is very small. So, meditate upon the idea of the difficulty of obtaining the prerequisites from the viewpoint of number. Now, just to elaborate on that a little bit, His Holiness Sakyatrichen said that in terms of the animal realm, of course, we have, you know, we see animals, we have interaction with animals, but that's only one of the three animal realms. There are actually two more that we don't see. We don't have any, I mean, unless you have some kind of clairvoyant ability, we don't see those other two. One of those realms is completely dark. The animals don't see each other. We can't see them. They bump into each other, and it's a really not a very nice place. I don't think he was talking about just deep in the ocean where there's no light. I don't believe he was talking about that. He said it's a sort of like a sub-realm. And then he said there's a third one, which is where the animals are all just jammed together in a really, really tight space. They can't move, they're bumping into each other, and it's really a horrible existence. So when they talk about the animal realm, just know that there's more to it than what we see. Sakyatrichen also said that starting with the hell realms and going up through the six realms, the number at the bottom is the greatest number, and as you go up, it's fewer and fewer and fewer. Till finally you get up to the human realm, there's much fewer, and then, you know, into the God realm, there's even fewer there. So that's another thing in terms of number. And then in terms of example, there's many examples given about this. Some of them are very kind of far out. But one of them that's given is, if you took a handful of beans and you threw it against the wall, what are the chances of one of them sticking? It is possible. Maybe there's a crack in the wall and the bean went in the crack, or maybe somebody left chewing gum and it stuck to the chewing gum. I don't know. But it's a pretty slim chance. So we should think that the actual possibility of having a precious human rebirth, which, remember, is not just a human rebirth. There's 18 qualities or boxes that have to be ticked, which we're going to go through, to qualify for a precious human rebirth. So that's the point of view of example. And Nochin Kunga Zangbo says, so even though there are unimaginable types of sentient beings, still it's almost impossible to obtain a precious human rebirth. Therefore, meditate upon the idea of the difficulty of obtaining the prerequisites from the point of view of example. From the point of view of nature, Nochin Kunga Zangpo says, to be free from the 8 unfavorable places and to acquire the 10 obtainments is very rare. Therefore, meditate upon the idea of the difficulty of obtaining the prerequisites from the point of view of nature. So, to explain that in more detail, the 8 unfavorable conditions which need to be avoided are being born as a hell being, being born as a hungry ghost, being born as an animal. Those are your three lower realms. Being born as a long-lived god, that's one of the higher realms, but it's still not where you want to be. Being born as a barbarian, I assume that means somebody who's strongly non-believer. Being born as a person with wrong beliefs. Being born as a person in a place where a Buddha has not come. So Buddhas just don't appear everywhere all the time. They only appear when there's enough merit by the beings there to receive the teachings. If the beings don't have enough merit to receive it, to get it, then the Buddhas don't appear because there's no point. So sometimes they appear and sometimes they don't. And they're called light ages and dark ages when that happens. Being born in a place where Buddha has not come, these are unfavorable conditions. Or being born with impairments that prevent learning and practicing. You have some kind of physical and mental impairment that stops you. That's an unfavorable condition. So that's 8 of the 18. And we have another 10 to go, and those are divided into two groups of 5. They're called the 10 obtainments. The 5 that are acquired by oneself, and the 5 that are acquired through others. The 5 self-obtainments are, well, just to be born as a human being. We already talked about you have to have morality and generosity to do that. So obviously to have a precious human rebirth, you have to be a human. So that's one of them that you self-obtain. To be born in a land where there are Dharma practitioners. It's pretty difficult to get enlightened on your own. Right? We need teachers and support groups and, you know, scholars and... So that's a condition. But also included in that condition is that we do not face legal repercussions for practicing the Dharma. And unfortunately, that's a reality in today's world. There are places where there are legal repercussions for being a Buddhist in this world. Another self-obtainment is to be born with sound organs, that is, not to be born with incomplete sense organs that obstruct listening, contemplation, and meditation. Mm-hmm. So not only be born as a human, but to have all the faculties to be able to do it, to receive instruction and contemplate and meditate. Mm-hmm. To not have committed any of the 5 heinous crimes, or even to have ordered others to perform them, or to have rejoiced in others performing them, which is the most common of those possibilities. Not necessarily doing it, but, somebody did that, that's great, you know. So what are the 5 heinous crimes? They are killing your father, killing your mother, killing an arhat. Arhat is the end result of the foundation path that we talked about previously. So those are the first 3. Drawing blood from a Buddha. We don't say killing a Buddha because you can't kill a Buddha. Buddhas, they don't die. They're beyond karma of death. But if you draw blood, that's a major heinous crime. And then the 5th one is causing a schism at any time that it's not right. And what that means is any time that schism is caused during the time of a Buddha. So it's not a heinous crime if you cause a schism and it's not during the time of a Buddha like now. It's still a major sin. But it's not considered one of the 5 heinous crimes. So that is an explanation of the 5 heinous crimes. And then in the quote by Nerchen Kunga Zangbo, he talks about another condition is you need to have faith in your heart in the teachings of the moral conduct of the Dharma. That's one of the attainments you get yourself. And just to clarify that a little bit, in Sakya Pandita's text called Clarifying the Sage's Intent, he says there's two kinds of Buddha nature. Everybody talks about Buddha nature. Well, we all have Buddha nature, it's just that it's covered up with afflictions, which is true. But that's kind of a, I don't want to say it's theoretical, but it's latent, so to speak. There's another kind of Buddha nature where people have propensity towards compassion, towards loving kindness, towards caring about others, towards being a good person. Some people are inclined in that direction. Not everybody's inclined in that direction. Everybody has Buddha nature, but some people have this propensity or this proclivity, and that's not latent. And those are the people or the beings that have a chance of jumping on the path and following the path. Other folks have that possibility theoretically, but they don't have the propensity in that direction. I mean, let's look around. How many people are there that aren't interested in Dharma? Lots. Mm-hmm. Not everybody has the propensity. So Sakya Pandita makes this distinction. That's what's referred to here when the quotation says, have faith in from your heart in the teachings and moral conduct of the Dharma. You're inclined in that direction. Nörchen Kunga Zangpo says about the five attainments. The five attainments acquired through others... Oh, this is the second type of attainment. The five attainments acquired through others are that a Buddha has come into the world, has taught the Dharma, the teachings have been maintained, in other words, they're still around, there are practitioners who practice it, and there are kind donors or the opportunity for right livelihood. So in other words, physical, material support for that. If you're so poor that all you can think about is your next meal, it's very difficult to be focused on spiritual practice. You're focused on survival. Mm-hmm. So that's an opportunity. That's one of these attainments. To have what they call the leisure. I'm not sure leisure. Mm. But the opportunity to just, I've got a moment, I could practice now. Mm. You know? And then he continues to say, thus the difficulty of obtaining the human body is endowed with the 18 prerequisites needed for the practice of Dharma. And this should be explained in accordance with your own and others' intelligence. So again, for some people this is really easy to understand if they have the proclivity. Other people might go, well, I don't know, you know. So we need to explain this at that person's level. Whoever's hearing this, you need to sort of adapt it so they can, you know, have a chance of grasping it. You don't want people rejecting it. You don't want to create aversion. That's really unfortunate. If somebody gets, you know, oh, this is nonsense, I'm never going to listen to Dharma again, that would be really a shame. So you need to kind of show some skillfulness in, if you're talking to somebody. Of course, this group is very advanced, we'll go into detail, but if you're talking to somebody that's new to this, you might want to just, you know, put it in a way that they can understand it and accept it and not reject it. So that's what he means, I think. His Eminence Daishin Rinpoche, who was a very, very great 20th century Lama, who very famous in Tibet and ended up living in Seattle, and actually ended up coming here to Victoria and teaching. And a lot of us went down to Seattle too. He was talking about this one time when he was here, and he said, well, you know, one time there was a visitor from China who went to Tibet, and he was, you know, standing in the back of the crowd listening to this teaching about how rare it is to have a human rebirth and how precious it is to have a human rebirth. And a Chinese guy said, well, that teacher's obviously never been to China. We got a lot of people. But again, it's just to show that it isn't just being human. That's only one of the 18. You got to check the other boxes to actually say you have a precious human rebirth. And the more you think about it, you know, I mean, look how many people are here now. So it's pretty rare. His Eminence Avikrita Rinpoche, who's he's one of the Kun family. He was actually born in Seattle, and he's possibly in line to maybe be the next Sakyatrizin when the term ends and they change. He said, we don't have to go through all 18 of these prerequisites in our heads every time before we practice, of course, but when we've already familiarized ourselves with them, then we can have an internal sense, a deep sense of how fortunate we are. And we can instantly go to that sense and let it inform our whole being before we undertake our practice until it becomes second nature for us. So that's his advice. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to introduce another commentator, a famous Sakya Lama, Garampa Sonam Senje, who lived from 1429 to 1489, considered a great, great scholar, philosopher, master. He was a student of Norchen Kunga Zangpo, who we know already, and he was also a student of Muchen Kuncho Gyaltsen, who's another great, you know, philosophy giant in the Sakya history. And Garampa Sonam Senje was the sixth abbot of Nor, the subsect Nor. And interestingly, he's widely recognized as a reincarnation of Drapa Gyaltsen, who lived 400 years before that. So here's what he said, Garampa Sonam Senje. Therefore, though I have somehow obtained this human body endowed with the prerequisites once, still I must meditate upon the idea that it should not be wasted. Rather, it should be used to achieve benefit for my next life. Now, from a Mahayana great vehicle point of view, benefit here means benefit for all sentient beings who have been our mothers in previous lifetimes who are suffering. That's understood. Okay. So in other words, it implies the bodhisattva motivation. Geshe Tashi Namgyo said, our next life is more important. Our next life is more dangerous. Be aware to not focus only on this life. Don't focus on the short term. If we work for the enlightenment for the sake of all beings, our temporary conditions will improve anyway. It's important to be aware of this particular function of the Dharma. To work for this life only is a waste. Lama Jampa Taye, who's a contemporary Lama, British Lama, said, the first contemplation, which is the precious human rebirth contemplation that we just did, the first contemplation exhorts us not to squander the precious opportunity we've been given. Right now, poised between birth and death, we possess a freedom to reflect that is characteristic of human life. And we also possess the fortune to have met the Dharma. We thus possess an indispensable working basis by which our potential for Buddhahood can be fulfilled. Yet, the inspiration generated by attentiveness to this precious moment of our human life must be tempered and simultaneously strengthened by acknowledging the fact of impermanence, the second contemplation. This is not the causal acceptance of impermanence, of externalities, so useful in a consumption-driven society where everything is disposable, but it's an acknowledgement in our very bones that there is no conditioned thing, including and especially our present existence, that escapes death. To know this through deep contemplation and meditation is to awaken to the possibilities inherent in this very life, in this very moment, and not to get lost in pursuit of the ephemera of the 8 worldly poisons. Have a nice day. So, that's the first contemplation of Precious Human Rebirth.
And what book was that, or what?
That was a quotation by Lama Jampa Taye, who's a British Lama, very good Lama. Mm. It was an oral talk he gave. Mm. So, that's the first contemplation of Precious Human Rebirth. The second contemplation of impermanence in death is actually quite long. So I think what I will do is stop or pause and say, are there any questions?
I have it. Okay, so in the beginning you said, I'm just curious about that. With regards to the 4 poisonous dichotomies, you said a few of them are hidden. What, can you talk more about that?
Well, the ones that are on the happy side, like happiness, pleasure, gain, fame. Remember we wrote a whole bunch of synonyms one day. I don't have the chart anymore. But all that left side, I mean, who doesn't want to be happy? Who doesn't want to have money? Who doesn't want to be, you know? Those are pretty, I think most people don't see those as poisons. And so in that sense, they're hidden if we don't have the insight to see, well, maybe there's downsides to that too.
And the downside to that would be like the attachment.
Exactly.
Because attachment is suffering.
Exactly. The 4 attachments. Yeah, it's not that you can't have money. I mean, we need money to live.
Yeah.
It's not, the money itself is not the problem. It's the attachment and the nasty stuff that can come out of that attachment, like greed, cheating, lying, stealing, murder, you know, all that stuff that could come out of there if you're depending on your level of attachment. So that's the attachment that we want to part from. Not the happiness and the money and all that. But it's tricky, you know, because it's seductive.
Yeah.
And mostly we're sucked into it.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly we don't see it as a problem.
Right.
I mean, look how many people buy lottery tickets.
That's right.
Or whatever, you know.
Or the scratch ones.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all?
No, I have another one.
Okay.
So, you were talking about including other beings that are thorough in their search to understand all this, and they came up with, like, metaphors for numbers regarding, like, the hell realm, the animal realms. How is it that one can trust those experiences? Do you just have to have faith? Like, how is it that they can even access the hell realm and see it in an aerial view where they're like, yep, that's a lot of them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'm wondering.
How do you know how many people are down there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good question. I don't know if you remember, but a long time ago we talked about faith and the different kinds of faith. And we said, we're not really interested in blind faith in Buddhism. We're interested in faith that makes sense, that we can put some reasoning to, that we can sort out, right? So it's not like, oh, we'll just believe it because somebody said it. That's not what we're saying here. However, having said that, as you go up the spiritual progression, and we're going to talk about this later, you get into what are called the bhumis or the levels of spiritual development, and you actually see the whole map. There are very advanced beings on those levels, spiritually speaking, who have amazing powers clairvoyance, clairaudience, ability to travel instantaneously to any realm, ability to manifest multiple bodies, ability to receive teachings from multiple Buddhas simultaneously. And the higher up you go, the more just unbelievable, really, these powers become, until you become fully enlightened Buddha, in which all of them become infinite. But as you go up that scale, up these bhumis, or they're called grounds or levels, whatever you want to call it, as you move up, you have the ability to go to these places like the hell realms and the animal realms, and actually not only see these beings, but help them. Mm. Actually, in some cases, if you have enough spiritual power and enough karma, you can actually take beings out of those realms if you're advanced enough. Mm-hmm. So there are beings who have gone and seen this and come back and said, this is the way it is. Mm-hmm. Now, it's true in the beginning, you sort of have to take their word for it. Mm-hmm. But in my own experience, you know, I've been studying and listening to teachers for more than 40 years, and I've never heard a lie yet. I trust these beings, these teachers, because they have proven, they've earned it. They've earned my trust. Mm-hmm. And it's true, I'm not able to fly off to realms and stuff like that. But honestly, I have no reason to doubt their word, because they've always been honest with me. Mm-hmm. And not only have they been honest with me, but I've tested what they've taught in my own life, and it's made my life better, and it makes sense, you know. So they're not interested in pulling the wool over your eyes. I mean, they're just not. And if you spend enough time with these teachers who are advanced teachers, I'm talking about real advanced beings, you can start to feel it. I mean, you know, they are good people. They are good beings. They're loving, they're kind, they're generous, they're honest. They walk the talk. They don't care about money or fame or power. They're just really incredible beings. And so, over time, you learn to trust them. And so these numbers, like there's more hell beings and so on, I haven't seen that directly. But I don't have any reason to doubt it. And someday, when we get up there, you know, you can go and see for yourself. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is. It is true, though, that we have limited perception. I mean, we know that even from studying our own bodies and color waves and sound. And, you know, dogs have smell senses that we don't have, and birds can see stuff we don't see. And, you know, it's obvious we have a limited perception. Our ability to perceive is limited. That's a given. So it makes sense that there would be things that I haven't seen yet. But at some point, when we develop spiritually, we'll get to that point, and you can confirm it. And I suspect that we'll find out that it's true. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it's not exactly blind faith. And it's always said, you know, you got to test it out and see, has it worked for me or not? Buddha said that. He said, don't believe what I'm saying just out of, you know, giving me honor. I don't want that. You're not honoring me if you do that. Go test it. Find out if it works for you. Because that's what he did. That's how he found out. Yeah, he looked for the truth, basically, is what he did. That's the answer, is we don't generally see those numbers ourselves yet. But, you know, I haven't been to Tahiti either, but I'm pretty sure that there is a place called Tahiti, because people that I know have been there. Is that half an answer?
That's great.
Okay.
Thank
you. No, it's a very important question, though. You know, like, well, how do you know? Okay. Got any more written on your hand?
No, that's it.
Oh. Anybody else have something written on their hand? Okay, so rather than opening up a whole giant topic of death, I think that now we can meditate on what we've heard this evening. So find a posture or a position that's comfortable for you. I like to take a couple of breaths before I start, just to transition my mind a little bit, if you want to do that. Tonight we heard the teaching on the precious human rebirth, which was pointed to by Sakyapandita. And this is a teaching that is good to contemplate so that we appreciate the human rebirth that we have, and also the conditions that we have of having generated the good karma and merit to be alive in a time when a Buddha has come and taught, and where the teachings are still alive, because even that will end someday, and where there are great masters who can explain the teachings to us and show us how to practice, give us an example of what's possible. And we have all the physical qualities that we need to listen to the teachings, contemplate them, and clarify them, and then meditate so that they go in deeper and become a part of us. And we also have the support system, the physical and material conditions to be able to have the time to engage in the spiritual development. It's really rare, even if we haven't been told that it's rare, if we stop and think about it. How many people have all those conditions? How many beings have all those conditions? So we are in a very, very fortunate place that we shouldn't take for granted, and we should take advantage of by practicing. So our life will become truly meaningful, so that we're able to help all sentient beings who've been our mothers and who are suffering now. Defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues, that I may dream to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, suffering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting and beseeching, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you.